Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Does the end of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan signal an end to the war on terror? My guest, who is a national security correspondent, has covered the nearly entire 20-year history of that conflict, says no. Spencer Ackerman says the conceptually flawed war continues until the ubiquitous surveillance of citizen and non-citizen alike, the detention without due process of detainees, and the suppression of immigration, legal and otherwise, ends. In his new book, Reign of Terror, he outlines the thesis that this erosion of American ideals and human rights, first utilized against perceived threats from abroad after 9/11, has now trickled into our own society. And today, we're bearing the same fruits that have affected the countries surrounding the nexus of the war: a shakier regard for human rights and a destabilized government. Ackerman outlines the abuses that began in the war on terror, morphed into our immigration enforcement system, was even contemplated against our own citizens during the massive peaceful protests for racial justice. Spencer Ackerman has reported for The New Republic, Wired, The Guardian, and The Daily Beast. He was a part of The Guardian's team that won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Edward Snowden's NSA leaks, and won a 2012 National Magazine Award for his reporting on Islamophobic FBI counterterrorism training. He writes the Forever Wars site on Substack, and his new book is titled Reign of Terror: How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. It's published by Viking. Spencer Ackerman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Rich.
Before we talk about Reign of Terror, first I have to get your assessment about the fall of Afghanistan, where purportedly the beginnings of the war on terror began slightly less than 20 years ago. Where do you see where the war on terror is, and what's your assessment of what happened over the last couple of months?
The war on terror survives the Taliban reconquest of Afghanistan because the mechanisms of the war on terror, the tools of it, not just the wars themselves, the ground wars themselves, but the apparatus of mass surveillance, the apparatus of the Department of Homeland Security that created a counterterrorism context for immigration, the apparatus of indefinite detention at Guantanamo Bay, all of these things, and the legal authorities undergirding them, the Patriot Act, all of these things still exist. They persist, and we shouldn't allow ourselves to believe that just because the Taliban have won in Afghanistan, that the war on terror has somehow been repealed or abolished. All of that work of abolition remains, and only when it's performed will the war on terror truly be over. In Afghanistan, what we've seen is that the 20-year American war has led to the creation of nothing enduring but human suffering. And I think there's a real big tendency that I've observed over the last five or so days of watching the coverage of this to believe that the overwhelming human misery that we're seeing at the airport in Kabul and elsewhere in Afghanistan is the result of the United States ceasing to fight the war. It's the result of the war itself. What do I mean by that? In December of 2001, the Taliban offered a conditional surrender after being routed by the United States' Afghan allies, and it told its principal Afghan, the U.S.'s principal Afghan ally, Hamid Karzai, that it would surrender, join a political process, and reconcile itself in that manner, provided that its leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, was allowed to live in some kind of house arrest in Kandahar. And Karzai, recognizing that if there was no political future for the Taliban, it would only seek a military future, and it had a proven ability, as we saw in 1996, to win an insurgency, to wage a successful insurgency and return itself to power. Donald Rumsfeld, speaking for the Bush administration, rejected that and said the United States would accept nothing less than unconditional surrender. And that's the real origin of the Afghanistan war as it lasts until this week, that the only thing that happens in the war is that the Taliban grow in strength, coalesce, begin an insurgency around 2005, and ultimately, the American responses are futile, that they lead only to the death and displacement of ever staggering numbers of Afghans, hundreds of thousands of people, the creation of millions of refugees. And if we kept fighting the war, we would have gotten much more of the same. We wouldn't have gotten some drastic break from the past somehow. No war is won at year 21. Instead, what we're seeing is the concealment of that reality in the discussion of this. When Donald Trump ultimately negotiates with the Taliban, which I think was the only valorous act of his otherwise disgraceful presidency, because it was a recognition that there was no alternative to negotiating an end to the war, fundamentally, the United States sought the same terms in 2020 that it rejected in 2001. And that, you know, we could talk about whether, you know, hypothetically, counterfactually, the Taliban would have lived up to their deal. But the point is that it was the same deal that the U.S. accepted when it had pretty much no leverage and rejected when it had the most leverage it would ever have in Afghanistan. Hmm.
Certainly, we've seen poignant scenes of thousands of Afghans trying to flee the country. The first public utterances of the Taliban seems to be far more reasonable than we would expect. But do you expect that reasonableness to continue?
I'm not good at predictions. I don't want to predict things. I think that it is fair to say that the way the tests for the Taliban are going to be their actions, and that things that the Taliban says when Westerners are still in the country and the eyes of the world are on them are probably not the time to invest a lot of meaning in those utterances. I've interviewed people who have negotiated with the Taliban directly. And among the things that they tell me that they observed about the Taliban over the last, in some cases, 10 years, 7 years, you know, 5 years, 2 years, is that they are aware pretty acutely that their international isolation on the eve of 9/11 was an enormous liability. And they seem to be interested now in a way that perhaps they weren't then in maintaining durable and real relationships with the rest of the world. And that is an opportunity to pressure the Taliban against committing acts of reprisal and against acts of widespread violence that may have expected. But the United States can't pretend like it can control Afghanistan. The United States can't pretend like the Taliban haven't won in Afghanistan.
No, that's absolutely correct. One of the things your book does, The Reign of Terror, it looks at this whole 20-year history of the war on terror. And your view is that, in fact, the war on terror, instead of internationally destabilizing places, which it certainly has, it's internally destabilized the U.S. and that it's morphed from a worldview very popular after 9/11 that others from various places that are a part of the war on terror were devoid of human rights, even their essential humanity. And that has morphed to immigrants coming here looking for a better life, to even citizens of color within the United States. Can you maybe shed a little light on the whole thesis of the book?
Sure. So the war on terror isn't really something new or innovative. It doesn't really create a lot of things. What it is a doorway to violent nativist racism that has existed throughout American history and given it an atmosphere of emergency to return to power, or in certain cases, I suppose, you might say, give it a new justification for entrenching the power that it had enjoyed at that moment. This was fueled in part by the deliberate decision to define the war on terror both euphemistically and vaguely, so that it wasn't, you know, perhaps we can better understand the point through drawing a contrast, it's not called the war on Al-Qaeda, or it's not called a series of, you know, intelligence and law enforcement operations to apprehend those, you know, culpable for the specific act of violence that 9/11 is. Instead, it's something much vaguer and much broader that the country kind of understands, you know, beyond the euphemism of the war on terror as like something Muslim, you know, maybe not every Muslim, but definitely exclusively only and always Muslims. And that atmosphere of suspicion continues and develops throughout the Bush years, through the Obama years, when we see, for instance, a community center in Lower Manhattan demonized as a ground zero mosque, as if it was Menace the Conqueror turning Hagia Sophia in Constantinople into a mosque, into Republican state houses around the country seeking to ban Sharia law while using language that we would come to see as a precursor to what the people chanting, the white supremacists chanting in Charlottesville would say. Newt Gingrich said this at the American Enterprise Institute in a 2010 speech, where he talks about the danger of Sharia law is that it is coming to replace the American way of life. The subtext of the war on terror throughout is a nativist current. It did not only impact Muslims. It impacted people who white people ignorantly presumed to be Muslims. There was violence against Sikhs throughout the 9/11 era because they were visibly brown and visibly non-Christian. Similarly, from the very start of the war on terror, the Attorney General under the Bush administration, John Ashcroft, had an immigration advisor who we've come since to become more familiar with. His name is Chris Kobach. And among the things that Kobach and Ashcroft pursued was creating registries of Muslim visitors to the United States that were here on visas, many of whom would end up being deported, taking roundups through the FBI of Muslim, you know, throughout Muslim communities, putting informants, this is again the acts of the FBI, inside Muslim communities within the United States, including in houses of worship, and constructing an architecture criminalizing association so that now the coercive and punitive and carceral elements of the United States government can apply not only to people who commit acts of violence, but to people who move money. Expansive categories of criminal association were established through tools like the Patriot Act that took definitions of criminal activity away from acts of violence and into things called material support, which is to say, perhaps not even necessarily knowingly, giving money to a charity or to a refugee cause that was either associated with or used as a front by a banned jihadist organization. All of these things together were there from the start. Immigration gets treated not as a way to make more Americans, but as a threat to Americans as they existed. And so people were thrown into prisons for essentially, you know, coercing them into becoming informants into their community because it was presumed that they knew something. They must have known something about further acts of terrorism within their communities. A really excellent book by Tran Nguyen called We Are All Suspects Now points out and, you know, tells the stories of people who are not Muslims at all, but were immigrants and were undocumented or were here on visas, getting thrown into the same system, regardless of, you know, the immediate pretext being, you know, supposedly Muslim terrorism.
I guess that criminalization of immigration actually during the Trump administration spread to a criminalization of peaceful protest. When you start seeing protests against police brutality and things like Black Lives Matter.
That's right. Trump ultimately says that Black Lives Matter are terrorists and tells the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, which are federal local law enforcement partnerships, to pursue cases against anti-fascist demonstrators. Throughout the war on terror, whether it was under Bush whether it was under Obama or whether it was under Trump, and now under Biden. These were the operations of the war on terror. They occurred both as a reaction by the political class that loosens the boundaries of what the security state is allowed to do, providing a lot of authoritarian possibilities in terms of surveillance, in terms of detention, and in terms of lethal action. Barack Obama, guided by attorneys, executes an American citizen without charge or trial because the CIA says it would just be too hard to apprehend him. I would suggest that if the war on terror continues, then we will see the execution of other American citizens in drone strikes or otherwise when political leaders come to see their adversaries, not as Americans to persuade, but as internal enemies. And that is what the war on terror provides an opportunity to do, all in the context of emergency, to sort real Americans from conditional Americans. And this has been part of the war on terror from the very beginning. Recently, particularly after the demonstrations in 2020 that were responded to by the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department, as you point out, there was a lot of talk about how the war on terror had come home. In fact, the war on terror had always been home. What happened was that certain aspects of the war on terror that were only originally thought to be used overseas would come home. And the longer this has persisted and continues to persist, the more those dangers and opportunities for authoritarian possibilities compound.
My guest today is Spencer Ackerman, a national security correspondent for nearly the entire 20-year history of the war on terror. He's written for The New Republic, Wired, The Guardian, and The Daily Beast. His new book is titled Reign of Terror: How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. I have to ask about the way you begin the book with the title, The Worst Terrorist Attack in American History. And it's not the event that most people would think, but it actually hits home very close to the heart of Oklahomans. And that is the Oklahoma City bombing. And you start the book with this terror attack to contrast how we responded to that event to later events of 9/11. In fact, you write that the rule of law was scrupulously noted in Timothy McVeigh's case. There were euphemisms calling him a survivalist rather than a white supremacist. And we scrupulously adhere to the rule of law in that case. Why is it important to talk about that? And of course, through the course of the book, you bring it full circle by the events of January 6, 2021.
Yeah, I'm grateful to talk to an Oklahoma audience. I'm a native New Yorker, so I have some sense of how the legacy of Oklahoma City is felt to you, the way the legacy of the 9/11 attacks is felt to me. You saw your neighbors die, and that's a profound and I can only think of as a life-changing experience. The reason why I needed to start with Oklahoma City is because in order to see the war on terror in its fullness and in its implication, we have to see who the exceptions to the war on terror get to be. We have to see how white supremacist terrorism, the oldest, most resilient, and most lethal form of terrorism throughout American history, is exempted. The ways in which, for in many cases, compelling civil libertarian reasons, the U.S. government does not criminalize the broad, not just, infrastructure of white supremacy that does not engage in violence. It also does not use existing laws to disrupt that infrastructure when it does engage in violence, but perhaps not as spectacular violence as in the Oklahoma City bombings. I start off in a part of northeastern Oklahoma in the mid-1990s called Elohim City, which is functionally a terrorist training camp pursuing a kind of white caliphate, a deeply violent, repressive, and misogynist place that claims religious justification under a perversion of Christianity called Christian Identity for its actions. And that infrastructure is allowed to persist. The mainstream politics of the Oklahoma City bombing, seeks very aggressively to hive off McVeigh from any of that broader infrastructure, both the militant infrastructure and then the non-criminal sympathetic infrastructure, because that is so deeply woven into mainstream American society in ways both overt and subtle. And only when we then see after the 9/11 attacks, the ways in which that exemption operates. No one calls for McVeigh to be executed without trial. No one calls for all of McVeigh's associates to be rounded up and tortured. No one calls for Navy SEALs to, you know, rappel out of helicopters and kill everyone in Elohim City. No one calls for Elohim City to be bombed. No one calls for any of the things that become instinctively pursued against Muslims after 9/11. And that's why it's important to see Oklahoma City as a prelude in contrast to what was about to happen.
Yeah. Through the course of the book, you write about the increased surveillance that took place after 9/11 that has been with us ever since. Torture, you recount the brutal, dehumanizing treatment detainees experienced during the early years of the war. And you then fast forward 10 years, and now we see that some of those techniques were used on immigrant detainees in some of the ICE detention centers. That is really, truly shocking how that sort of morphed and progressed.
Once torture is normalized, once it is excused, once it is explained away, once it is seen as not torture, once it is seen as justified, then we're willing to do anything to anyone. And I don't think we will ever find a piece of paper that tells the Department of Homeland Security, you know, hold migrants in holding cells where we manipulate the temperature in order to make it unbearably cold or unbearably hot, just like we did in the CIA black sites. But we don't need to, because a study of American history demonstrates just how deeply ingrained these torture techniques are. Mechanisms like child separation were tools of native genocide and tools of chattel slavery. Things like stress positions, which the CIA and the military use in the black sites and at Guantanamo, are also mechanisms familiar from slavery. These are tools that Americans have had, white Americans in particular, in their toolboxes, that is to say, the infrastructurally speaking, since there has been an America. And so those are the tools they're going to reach for. To give one other example, you know, when I saw that, you know, they were using these things, I always forget how to pronounce the name properly, so I apologize, in Spanish. These things that are basically ice boxes for migrants, all I could think of was Ghul Rockman in the salt pit black site in Afghanistan being left to freeze to death after he had been kept in a cold room, doused with water, and kept naked from the waist down. That this similarity was just too conspicuous that it had to be explored.
You write at the end of the book, and earlier in our conversation, you mentioned that, you know, the war on terror will continue and won't be abolished until the surveillance, detention, and immigration suppression that has destabilized the United States ends in the United States. I have to ask, you know, I'm speaking from a very red state, and the belief that this system has kept Americans safe is so ingrained. I'm wondering if the very act of dismantling it would be destabilizing. How can the U.S. accomplish this at this particular point? And is there an opportunity, given the fall of Afghanistan, to dismantle some of these tools that have been used in the war on terror?
Well, I hope my book serves as something of a catalyst for a reckoning with what these past 20 years have meant, what they've done, and what their works are, what they've yielded. And I think that nothing is hopeless. I think that, you know, when people organize, they can force their political leaders into strict choices between maintaining power and maintaining the war on terror. And that's possible. And that doesn't even have to be ideological. There has been quite a great antipathy that we can also see from the MAGA coalition to certain aspects of the war on terror, particularly when they see, you know, even if it is a somewhat paranoid interpretation, but not entirely so, that these operations may come to affect them after January 6th. There are opportunities if people are willing to stand with one another and willing to be courageous and willing to be unrelenting in their demands on their political leadership of both parties, because both parties created and maintained this war, as did the security services. And so I don't think anything is hopeless. I don't think anything is fated. But if we view it like that, then what are the consequences of that? The consequences of that are that future generations, I have two children, I don't know if you have children, but our children will have to live with the consequences of an ever insecure future, a future that, as the United States seeks this violent domination, precludes opportunities necessary to forestall the actual threats that we actually face, whether from climate change or from the pandemic, things that one country can't solve by itself. And we also break solidarity with all of the victims of the war on terror, with all of the people that will continue to suffer, die, and lose their freedom and have their wealth stolen from them, if we simply say, you know, this is just going to be the way it's going to be, and, you know, how awful. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that's a future we have to have.
The political will, do you think that it's in the leadership? You write that Obama missed a historic opportunity after the death of Osama bin Laden to do that. And you quote Ben Rhodes, who said, you know, if we'd done that and we had a terrorist incident the next year, we would have been basically vilified for doing that. Do you think there's a will within political leadership to change some of these things, the surveillance, the detention, you know, the way the war on terror has evolved?
No, I think there's no political will to do any of that. I think the public has to force their leaders, their politicians, into a choice where perhaps against their interests, they will have to dismantle the war on terror or lose power. I don't think we can ever just simply trust the politicians and the structures that maintain the war on terror to abolish it. No, it has to be demanded by the public.
Spencer Ackerman, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much for allowing me to talk to an Oklahoma audience.
National security correspondent Spencer Ackerman is the contributing editor at the Daily Beast and also writes the Forever Wars site on Substack. His new book is titled Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.